touched me, and I just couldn't believe it. I had not seen him since sixth grade, and he contacted me and said that he read my book and that George Floyd led him to read my book. He said he had heard about the book, but he had procrastinated. But when everything happened and, you know, it was kind of like you can't ignore it anymore, he went back and read and purchased the book and told me about how the book impacted him, how he had to come to the realization that his parents were racist. And they weren't out and out racist, but he actually said that we have to basically wrestle our demons, our racial demons, in the light. You know, we've got to bring this stuff to light. And it made me feel like this is one of the reasons that this book is important, is because it is making people see the other side, because I don't think that our story has been told by us enough for people to hear it. I try to express it and say, you know, put yourself in my place just for a minute. You know, I'm a 5-year-old. I go outside. I don't have sidewalks. I've got this tar gravel street, but I get in the car with my dad and we go to the Safeway every Saturday. And I see 3 blocks from my house across Lee Highway how the white people live on Buchanan Street. They have sidewalks. They have asphalt streets. And their parents have this, pay the same level of tax that my parents pay. I said, so, you know, when you look at it from a kid's perspective, I think that it helps them to see it in a different light.
Wilma Jones, this has been wonderful. Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you, Sarah, for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed it.
Wilma Jones is the author of My Halls Hill Family, More Than a Neighborhood. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. The golden age of gospel music in the 1940s and 50s brought us well-known greats like Mahalia Jackson and Sister Rosetta Tharpe. But what about the gospel music that came later, when hip-hop and soul were dominant in African-American music? Claudrina Harold is an historian at the University of Virginia. Her new book, When Sunday Comes, takes a deep dive into Black gospel music of the 80s and 90s and the culture that surrounded it. Claudrina, When Sunday Comes, Gospel Music and Soul and Hip-Hop Eras, is not written just by the historian in you, but also by the you who grew up in a family who loved and appreciated gospel music. Play for me one of the earliest songs you fell in love with.
Aretha Franklin's Mary, Don't You Weep. The voice, the passion, the mystery, her technical proficiency as a vocalist was as apparent to me as the singularity of Michael Jordan. When you think about the African-American singing tradition, the cultural tradition, the musical tradition, and the importance of call and response as a formal gesture, but also as a way in which community is made.
What incredible power and star power and almost sexual tension in the way she belts out this gospel piece.
No doubt, no doubt. I mean, power, humor, spirituality, And oh, her impeccable sense of timing.
And that live audience loving it every step of the way.
Every step of the way. And them urging her, egging her on. And then for her to say, you know, he gets up walking like a natural man. And of course, here you see that tension between the secular and the sacred. In fact, I would say there's no tension at all when Aretha Franklin is involved, because she just obliterates any division. She is in the church, but as an artist, she takes us to church. And it's very important to understand that when she comes out with Amazing Grace in 1972, which until I think Whitney Houston's Preacher's Wife was the biggest selling gospel album of all time, this is a turbulent moment. This isn't a post-Malcolm X. This is a post-King nation. This is a post-John Kennedy nation. These are the Nixon years. But also when you think about music, you know, the year before that, Marvin Gaye comes out in April, you know, with What's Going On. Of course, Sly Stone responds in December of 1971. There's a riot going on. And so in a moment where the world has turned dark, even the music has turned dark, and it's opening up for this cultural explosion that we call funk, Aretha is bringing the good news. She's bringing the gospel. This is a monumental moment, and this is a crossover smash. This album remains on the top of the gospel charts for years, and of course, this is an album that she mates with the institution builder and the king of gospel, James Cleveland. But this is an album that ushers in a new moment in gospel music where people can think about the commercial possibilities of gospel. And of course, we know that during this period, you have the Staple Singers taking us there. But we also know that 4 or 5 years before the release of Amazing Grace, there's another crossover smash that comes out, really, or hits the airwaves in 1968, and that's Edwin Hawkins' Oh Happy Day. Listen to those jazz chords. Listen to the fusion of gospel and pop, but also listen to the distinctiveness of that classic California sound. You can hear it.
What is that device in gospel music, that moment?
It is when Sunday comes. it is this high note, this collective note, this collective response. It sounds like, you know, the sound of celebration, the sound of joy, the sound of a breakthrough. One might even say it's the sound of Pentecost. You know, the great civil rights activist and scholar Wyatt T. Walker, you know, often said that, you know, what Black people are singing religiously will provide you with a clue as to what is happening to them sociologically. And when I hear that song, I can hear the joy of 1968. I can hear this sense of possibility that we're breaking into something new. And indeed, that's what, you know, Oh Happy Day did. I mean, it was a international smash. With that crossover success and with that popularity emerges criticism. So within the field of gospel music, there has always been this debate about crossover success and how much, you know, should gospel music incorporate the sounds of soul and funk? And of course, if we move to the present moment, you know, let's say hip hop. Of course, the problem with those debates is that they don't take into account that many of the many of the genres and you know that we would classify as secular, R&B, hip hop, funk, emerge from and draw influence from gospel music. So when we begin to think about Black music, there's a fluidity between the sacred and the secular.
Why did the church people think gospel had gone too far? What was wrong with gospel crossing over?
One of the issues is, you know, this question of sound, and I think within gospel, the desire to preserve what some people consider what's formally distinct about the gospel art form, whether it be a particular melody, whether it be harmonic structure, whether it be how many times you need to say Jesus or God. So in the 1980s, for example, there emerged this debate that some artists like BB and CC Winans, or even earlier with Andre Crouch, that they were making music that didn't say Jesus enough, or there was this lyrical ambiguity. So I think there's this sense that when the listener hears gospel music, they need to know that it's gospel music. Right. And there's this question about, can spirit exist in any form? And I think even when you look at artists that cross over, and here I want to turn to the Clark Sisters. And the Clark Sisters, a group born in Detroit, based in Detroit, the early 1980s, they had really their first crossover smash, You Brought the Sunshine. And you can hear the ways in which their lead composer, organist, Twinkie Clark, you can hear the ways in which she fuses gospel, jazz, and also disco.
Oh, they're great. It reminds me a little bit of Donna Summers.
Yeah, really? you definitely hear that disco. And I mentioned disco, I should have mentioned reggae. And of course, this is the ways in which a song can connect you to so many traditions and so many forms. It is the unbroken circle.
You write that the mother of the Clark Sisters was almost thrown out of church for the song, even though, of course, she wasn't part of it. What was controversial?
So their mother, Mattie Moss Clark, who was the musical director of the Church of God in Christ and really a central figure in terms of gospel history. You can't tell the story of gospel without Mattie Moss Clark. I mean, she not only trained her daughters, but she trained so many amazing musicians that came out of Detroit. But this song was a big hit, and so they performed on the Grammy Awards, and I think it was 1983, and they tear the stage up. I mean, they just wreck it. And their mom performs with them. And for some people in the church, this was too much. And so there's always these debates about the spaces that gospel musicians inhabit. Oh. Should your music be played in the disco? Should you perform at, you know, a secular award show? There's always, should you sign with a secular label? In fact, my family is somewhat connected to some of those debates. There was another gospel song that had that same success, and that was the Mighty Clouds of Joy's Mighty High, which came out in 1975 and was produced by a pretty established artist, producer, songwriter from Jacksonville named Dave Crawford, who was my uncle. And it was a hit. It reached number one on the disco charts. So this song is being played in discos across the nation. And it's also being played at discos where there are men and women and men dancing together. And so this is also connected to gay life and that's some of it. And so in 1976, Jet Magazine has a cover story, and it's like, you know, has gospel music gone too far? And they actually would call that gospel rock. And there's this debate between James Cleveland, you know, the once again the king of gospel and the Mighty Clouds of Joy, about this song. And it's about gospel, it was about gospel being in a space and also being taken seriously. So with James Cleveland, I really want to complicate it a little more. And it's not always just about, you know, tension, because sometimes it's just, you know, Black people, Black artists working certain things out. It's about thinking about, okay, what's good for the art form? What's not good for the art form? And that it's a good artistic move. I mean, this is why James Cleveland in 1968 created the Gospel Music Workshop of America, which drew thousands of delegates. Well, they would spend, you know, a week and a half talking about gospel music, talking about the business of gospel, talking about what's good for the art form and what's not good for the art form.
And then bringing it back to their local churches.
And bringing it back to their local churches, because that is where the music lives and will always live, is in the church. And one of the folks who is extremely important when we think about that is John P. Key. John P. Key was an artist born in Durham, North Carolina. As he notes, outside the county line, he had a distinctive kind of regional flavor. And also, this is an interesting time in African-American political life and cultural life, because this is also a moment in the 80s and the 90s where African-Americans are also moving back to the South. And he celebrates the South, he celebrates his Southern heritage, and he also celebrates his relationship with God. One of my favorite songs from him is Lily in the Valley, and it just captures his artistic singularity. And I love to hear that now.
Dazzling, my Lord, is in the valley, and that's bright as the morning star. It's in the valley, and it's bright as the morning star. There is a little egg in the valley.
Oh my God, it's so stirring and hypnotic at the same time.
Yes, it's just gut bucket soul.
Yeah.
it's like gut bucket soul. It's like it's like Sam and Dave with a dash of Otis Redding. And it represents the rhythms of the South and the particular rhythms of North Carolina. And that's something that's also so important about gospel music and its evolution, is how the art form reflects regional dynamics. There's something distinctive that comes out of a place like North Carolina that not only gives us John P. Key, but also gives us Shirley Caesar, who has achieved a level of success and a level of a longevity that is unmatched. In 1987, she releases a hugely successful album, Live in Chicago. That same year, she wins a seat on Durham City Council, Durham, North Carolina. She embraced an activist Christianity. I think she embraced a sort of liberation theology. She embraced the idea that you had to be concerned with the material conditions of people, and so she wanted to deal with the effects of deindustrialization. She wanted to deal with the problem of homelessness. She wanted to deal with the issue of urban development and making sure that it dealt with the problems of the working poor.
Right.
And even as she was engaged in politics, she was creating music that also reflected those concerns. And so in 1987, once again, she came out with an album, Live in Chicago. And the most popular song, or I should say sermonette, on that album was called Hold My Mule, which she tells the story of an 86-year-old farmer who had joined what she called a dead church, a church that frowned upon his religiosity and his expressiveness.
He
Classic.
That is great.
Yes, yes. Right? That is like Zora Neale Hurston on wax. On this sermonette, I think Shirley Caesar demonstrates both her unrivaled skills as a storyteller and her ability to capture the class tensions gripping Black America during the post-civil rights era. And in this moment, I think she also complicates conventional narratives. I mean, this is a successful farmer. Interestingly enough, in a moment where Black people are losing land, in a moment where there's lawsuits against racial discrimination in terms of land ownership, but she's giving us a different narrative. She's saying, not one time have I been to the courthouse. You know, not one time have I been to the cemetery, but you don't want me to dance in your church. Classic. And it's amazing. No matter how often I hear that song, I still get chills. So at the height of her popularity in the 80s, Shirley Caesar's label mate was Al Green. And he had a decade-long career in the gospel music industry, won Grammys, and made some amazing albums. But there is one song on his album, Call Me, from 1973, called Jesus is Waiting. And it is classic Al Green, classic the union of the spirit and the flesh, the secular and the sacred. And we're going to play the song, but I also suggest that you watch the video of Al Green singing Jesus is Waiting on Soul Train.
Jesus is waiting. Oh, yeah. Don't let yourself down. Yeah. Standing right there behind you, helping you to make up your mind.
So one of the arguments I make in the book is that Al Green's decision to embrace gospel was not just a spiritual one, but an aesthetic one, an artistic one as well. It's 1980, hip hop is emerging. That Southern, classic Southern soul that we associate with Muscle Shoals and Memphis and Stax Records, it's fading. And you are an artist that has so much range, but there's something very distinctively Southern about you. And I think what gospel allowed Al Green to do was be as Memphis soul as he wanted to be, but to be as Nashville country as he wanted to as well. And so for me, I wanted to tell the story of how gospel as an art form enabled Al Green to grow artistically. And I would say that we have those moments now. When I think of Kanye West making a gospel album, and no matter how you may think about the quality of the album, gospel music is, especially for African Americans, is so central to sort of mainstream culture as well. Beyonce, you know, the decision to sing Precious Lord, Take My Hand on the Grammys. It's like, yeah, I'm Beyonce and I do all of these things, but I'm a part of this tradition and I want you to know that I can nail this song too. And so thinking about Al Green opens it up for us to have that kind of conversation about gospel music, how it's so central, and that it's not just an art form that is important to people who regularly go to church or regularly listen to the music, but it informs everything. That's why it deserves a central place in our conversation about the development of this nation and its cultural gifts to the world.
Claudrina Harold is an historian at the University of Virginia. Her new book is When Sunday Comes, Gospel Music in the Soul and Hip-Hop Eras. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients. UVAHealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Cassandra Deering and Aviva Costo are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.